Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, and we summarize some of the big issues concerning science and society. Well, today, instead of bringing on a special guest, I'd like to answer many of the emails and questions that I get. Recently, I was on Reddit.com, and there were about a thousand questions that came pouring in concerning my latest book. It's called The Future of Humanity, about our destiny in outer space. And it just hit the New York Times bestseller list under the nonfiction paperback category. So I'd like to answer some of these questions, but put them in category form. One category concerns, well, the latest developments concerning black hole physics. How dangerous are they anyway? I mean, we see Hollywood movies about black holes, but really now, from a scientific point of view, how dangerous are they? And then, speaking about outer space, solar flares are in the news. It turns out that scientists now think that in the year 775, the Earth was hit with a gigantic, monstrous solar flare from the Sun. And what would happen if we were to hit once again with a monster solar flare from outer space? And then the United Nations recently came out with a report, a rather depressing report, stating that 1 million species on the planet Earth face extinction because of, well, human activity, because of you and me. So we'll talk about what it would be like if we were to be dislodged from the top of the food chain because there is an extinction cycle going on right now, instigated by human activity. And then going back to outer space, the moon is in the news. The Israelis recently sent a probe to the moon. Unfortunately, it crashed. Meanwhile, the Chinese have announced a rather ambitious plan to create a manned settlement in the southern part of the moon. So we're going to have a traffic jam around the moon with NASA, SpaceX, the Chinese, the Israelis, the Indians, all of them putting their sights on the moon. And then on the health front, it turns out that there is a new link emerging between, of all things, autism and Parkinson's. Now, why should that be, given the fact that Parkinson's involves mainly older people, while autism involves mainly young people, but there is a link, still a rather controversial link, but a link for which there is theoretical and experimental evidence. So we'll talk about a radical new theory of autism and Parkinson's, which is now being tested in the laboratory. And speaking about DNA, some people ask me the question, what are some of the strangest stories, breakthroughs being made in DNA and medical research? Well, let's just jump right into some of the questions that I get. One set of questions, of course, is about black holes because of the fact that we now have a picture of a black hole at the center of the galaxy M87, a monster black hole. It weighs 6.5 billion times the mass of our sun. But the question is, how dangerous are they anyway? Well, the black holes that we're talking about are galactic. They are not dangerous because, first of all, they're thousands of light years from Earth. The black hole in M87 is about 55 million light years from the planet Earth. In the center of our own galaxy, we have the one in the constellation Sagittarius. That black hole in the center of our own backyard is about 20,000 or so light years from the planet Earth. And we basically orbit around the event horizon of the black hole. If you were to fall inside the event horizon, you would be crushed. But as long as you orbit outside the black hole, there's no problem at all. And that's why the sun and the solar system are not eaten up. However, that said, we have to also point out that recently scientists have discovered wandering black holes that could actually sneak up on you, catch you by surprise, and then eat you and not even burp. These wandering black holes are the remnants of individual stars, not galaxies, but stars, that are massive enough so that when gravity crushes them, they form a black hole. And they are wandering. How do we know they're wandering? Because they're invisible, of course, right? So how do we know that one black hole is sneaking up on you? Well, first of all, maybe you've seen the movie Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger. In that movie, we have an invisible monster, but you can see the outline of the monster as it moves in front of, let's say, mountains and trees and forest. You can see the distortion, and the distortion looks very much like a human figure. That's how you locate the predator. In the same way, we locate wandering black holes by looking at distortions of starlight as it moves in front of a star. That's how we know that these wandering black holes are really there. And then we plot them. And then we realize that these wandering black holes are wandering in the disk of the Milky Way, but they're off the plane, and they probably will not intersect our solar system. Because if they did, it would create havoc. Now, what could happen if one day we are approached by a wandering black hole, a different one, one that catches us by surprise? Well, it wouldn't be pleasant. First of all, the black hole would encounter the Oort cloud of comets surrounding the solar system at a distance of about a light year. And then you would see comets and fragments of comets and debris being scattered in all directions. You would begin to see the fact that something is approaching you. And then even like planets like Pluto could be flung into outer space. And because it's a star we're talking about the star being big enough to even fling Saturn and Jupiter into outer space, Mars included, and of course the Earth could be eaten up in the process. Now, this black hole would probably weigh perhaps 5-10 times more massive than our sun, and in principle could eat up the Earth, Mars, Mercury, and even the sun itself if it were to get too close. Now, again, we don't think this is going to happen anytime soon, but it's something that cannot be ruled out. Because even though galactic black holes are more or less stationary, even though we orbit around them at a very safe distance, we have to worry about the unexpected, and that is a wandering black hole that could literally catch you by surprise and have you for lunch and not even notice. And speaking about outer space, there was a new discovery recently going through the ancient records of carbon-14, showing that in the year 775, something dramatic happened. It happened not just in one place, but around the entire surface of the Earth. There was some kind of radioactive activity in the year 775. Well, scientists analyzed the record, and they did find references to some ancient texts saying that there were weather distortions in 775. At that point, some astronomers said, aha, solar flare. A gigantic solar flare hit the Earth in the year 775. It didn't wipe out humanity because we didn't have electronics back then. And we had another one in 1859, which was well documented. That's the Carrington event. Carrington was the astronomer who was observing the sun when he realized that there was this tremendous explosion on the sun with radiation pouring out. And yes, shortly afterwards, this radiation hit the Earth, causing all sorts of atmospheric disturbances. Northern lights were seen as far as Cuba. Telegraph wires spontaneously bursting into flames. Now, back then, in 1775 and also in 1859, we didn't have any electronics except telegraph wires, and so that was the extent of the damage. However, with modern technology, we can now estimate what would happen today if such an event were to happen once again, and the results are not pretty at all. We're talking about our satellites being knocked out, which means the internet, telecommunications would be destroyed, astronauts would be endangered, satellites, astronauts, rockets in space would all have to be put on alert, and on the Earth, power stations would be short-circuited, meaning that there would be global blackouts. Rescue crews will not be coming because the rescue crews themselves have power blackouts. Food riots could happen within days because without electricity, food will decay very rapidly. And food riots could burst out as people race to the store and clamor for whatever foods are left. Well, now that we've been alerted about the dangers of these things, the first question is, well, how often are they? And second of all, what can we do about it? Well, we now realize that potentially these things happen much more frequently than we previously thought. Not just one in 1,000 years, but every few decades, a gigantic solar flare on the scale of the Carrington event happens, but we dodge the bullet. In other words, many of these solar flares originate from the sunspots. The sunspots on the surface of the sun are like gigantic storms, but they're also like the gun barrel of a rifle. They shoot out gigantic coronal mass discharges, solar flares, but most of the time they miss the Earth. So the Earth is like a sitting duck out there in outer space with a rifle being pointed at it that rotates with the rotation of the sun. Now, because there's so much real estate out there in outer space, for the most part, when the solar flares erupt out of a sunspot, the ejection of coronal mass misses the Earth. But once in a while, there's a direct hit, causing tremendous havoc to the atmosphere and to the levels of radiation on the surface of the Earth. So we know two things. A, they're much more common than we thought on a scale of several in a decade, for example. One of them practically wiped out the electricity in Quebec, Canada, for example. But for the most part, they missed the Earth. In 1859, there was a direct hit. Apparently in 775, there was a direct hit. So direct hits are rare, but they are A, unpredictable, and B, when they happen, watch out. So what can you do about these things? Plenty. You can, first of all, reinforce our power stations, create backup systems, and shield our satellites. It wouldn't take much. We're talking millions, not billions of dollars. But if a solar flare were to hit us now, property damage, we physicists estimate, would be on the scale of $2 trillion. That's trillion with a T, not a B. So we're talking about taking a huge chunk of the economic vitality of the planet Earth if we were to be hit with another Carrington event. So when might another Carrington event happen? We don't know. We just know that it is inevitable. It's a crapshoot. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. We've been dodging the bullet several times a decade, but because there's so much real estate out there and out of space, so far we have been lucky, very lucky to miss these solar flares. And also bad news from the United Nations. The United Nations is one organization that looks at the state of the Earth and comes out shaking its head, stating that we're in big trouble. This time it's a question of biodiversity and life extinction on the planet Earth, the fifth extinction. First of all, according to the United Nations, 1 million species of animals and plants are at risk, and 1/4 of all known plant and animals species are at risk. And just remember that the rate of extinction, according to the United Nations, is now 100 times greater than in the past 10 million years. So we're witnessing a spike in the number of extinctions being taken place around the planet Earth. Now, you might say to yourself, who cares? I mean, after all, we're just talking about some icky spiders and snakes. I mean, who cares about them? Well, you have to realize that there is a food chain. We're on the top of the food chain, and it wouldn't take much to dislodge us from our exalted position in the top of the food chain. For example, at the very bottom of the food chain, we find the oceans. The oceans give rise to algae, plankton, which in turn feed the fish, and the fish eventually feed us. So if something were to be happening to the oceans because of rising temperature and acidity of the ocean, we would be affected because the fish population would drop dramatically. And speaking about fish, take a look at our grains, wheat, corn, soybeans. If there was a disruption in the weather, we could see a collapse in the food chain that feeds the planet Earth. And just remember that summer is about a week longer than normal because of global warming. Every farmer knows this. And one day we could see a disruption of the food chain and, well, guess who's on top of the food chain? And it wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take much to dislodge us from our position. So in other words, we've had extinction cycles before. Comets, meteors perhaps, instigated some of these extinction cycles, like the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And the conclusion of this UN report is, basically, another comet has hit the Earth. This comet is called Homo sapiens. And also, speaking about outer space, let's talk about the moon. A race to the moon is heating up, not between the two great superpowers, but for scientific and national interests, we're going back to the moon. First of all, the Israelis sent a probe to the moon. Unfortunately, it crashed. However, the Chinese announced recently that it plans to go to the moon, and it plans to go to the moon and set up a base in the southern sector of the moon. Now, remember that when our astronauts from the Apollo space program landed on the moon, they landed near the equator of the moon. The Chinese have announced that they plan to use the Long March rocket to send their astronauts to the moon to build a base in the southern part of the moon, which has not been explored that much. Now, we should also point out that the Chinese space program is quite methodical. They are basically playing copycat to the United States and the Russians, methodically going step by step by step. First, they send rockets into outer space to establish the trajectory of their satellites. Then they send astronauts orbiting around the Earth. Then they send a space station into outer space with their astronauts. Then they send unmanned probes to the moon. And finally, they're going to send taikonauts, that is humans, to visit the moon and plant the Chinese flag on the moon. Now, not to be outdone, we're going to have a traffic jam around the moon because NASA also intends to go back to the moon after a 50-year gap. NASA has the SLS booster rocket, which is ready to be fired up, and it has the Orion space capsule. However, that said, we should point out, in all fairness, there are problems. First of all, delays, agonizing delays with the SLS booster rocket, not to mention the fact that in addition to the delays, costs have been skyrocketing. For example, it's been estimated by some analysts that each SLS launch could cost $1 billion. $1 billion for a single launch, and how often are we going to have these launches? Maybe once a year. Well, along comes Elon Musk with SpaceX, who says, bah, humbug. You should inject a little bit of private enterprise and innovation and initiative and risk-taking, and it plans to launch its Falcon Heavy for a fraction of $1 billion several times a year. Well, we'll have to see whether or not the boast is carried out, but we should also point out that Jeff Bezos of Amazon, formerly the richest man in the world, has endowed an entire spaceport in Texas, and he wants to launch his rockets into outer space and the moon as well. He's planning the new Armstrong rocket, a moon rocket, and we could be seeing a traffic jam around the moon. Prices, in the meantime, are dropping dramatically. For example, if you take your car and commute to work, and after one trip you junk your car, why, it would cost a fortune. It would cost a fortune a car each time you go to work. Well, that's the space program. Every time we shoot a missile into outer space, what do with the missile? We junk it. We don't reuse it. And that's where the reusable rocket comes in. Elon Musk with SpaceX has on several occasions successfully launched rockets and then retrieved the missile casing itself, dropping costs dramatically. And that's why SpaceX says that it could launch the Falcon Heavy several times a year at a fraction of $1 billion, which could create a whole new game changer with regards to the economics of space travel. Right now, it costs about $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit. That's your weight in gold. So think of your body made out of solid gold. That's what it costs you just to put you into orbit around the Earth. Now, to go to the moon would cost about $100,000 a pound. To go to Mars may cost about $1 million a pound. So we're talking about enormous amounts of money. However, when rockets become reusable, prices are going to drop. And plus technology, miniaturization, the computers, all of them have given us efficiencies that we didn't have before. And so that's why I say that our grandkids, who knows for sure, but our grandkids may be in a position to honeymoon on the moon. Now, I get another question, a set of questions, this time about medicine. And people want to know, what do I think is perhaps the most unusual, not the most substantive, but the most unusual theory that's out there in the medical field? Well, I would have to admit that one of the most unusual theories out there, which may actually be correct, involves Parkinson's disease and autism. First of all, what's the link between these two diseases? Parkinson's affects old people. It causes, let's say, tremors of your hand and body. Autism, well, a lot of young people are afflicted with autism. And that question is, what is the link between them? Well, scientists who've taken a fresh look at both incurable diseases have noticed a few similarities. First of all, there's an unusually large number of people with autism and Parkinson's disease who have problems with bowel movements and their gut, with their intestinal activity. Strange. Why should there be a link? Meanwhile, another theory is being developed, which says that we should really study the germs that exist within our intestines. Now, if you think about it, some people might think, ooh, that's icky. But think about it for a moment. There are hundreds, thousands of germs in our gut, and we really haven't studied them that much, and we don't really know what their effects are. Well, scientists who then taken a look at this realize that there's a very close link between the gut and the brain, of all things. We neglected this before. We didn't think much of it. But it turns out that if you take a look at the neural activity, the blood activity, there's a very close correlation between your gut and your brain. What happens in your gut affects your brain. Now, who would have thought? This means that scientists, believe it or not, are taking fecal material, fecal material, processing it, and then feeding it to animals and giving it to humans and finding remarkable coincidences in the relationship between fecal material and diseases. First of all, it's possible to raise mice in a germ-free environment where they have literally no diseases, no bacteria in their gut. And then you suddenly give them food that has fecal material with lots of germs on it, and immediately they come down with a whole horrible set of symptoms which seem to resemble, to some degree, autism and Parkinson's disease. Amazing. So this is still a theory, but it's a theory that's now being taken rather seriously to look at the relationship. Maybe the gut, which was once considered to be off limits for aesthetic reasons, maybe that bacteria in the gut has something to do with defects in neural activity. It's a novel idea. There's several interesting clues that are being pursued, and there's some actual results showing that, yes, indeed, maybe there is a link. So maybe it's not an accident. Maybe it's not an accident that people with Parkinson's and autism suffer from constipation and many other gastrointestinal ailments. Maybe there's a link. And another question has come into me, and that question is, well, what are some of the strangest developments that I follow concerning DNA research and cutting-edge neural research? What are some of the most interesting, unusual results? Well, one result which was controversial when it first came out years ago is now being pretty much accepted by the scientific community, and this concerns the people of Mongolia. When you analyze the Y chromosome, the Y chromosome is inherited from the father. Not just that, but it's inherited without mutations and alterations from the father. So when they analyzed the Mongolian people, they found something bizarre. And that is, most of them seem to have the same Y chromosome. Now that sounds ridiculous. It seems to indicate that maybe one man or his descendants gave birth to most of the Mongolian people. And by doing that, we find that, my God, perhaps, just perhaps, it was Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan and his children, which literally gave birth to the Mongolian people. And sure enough, if you read ancient texts about the lifestyle of Genghis Khan, you realize that he had huge harems. He would collect these huge harems and concubines every time he conquered a people. And perhaps that's where the Mongolian people came from. Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to continue our discussion of genetics. We're going to bring on one of the world's leaders in genetics. This is a man who literally brought back a near-extinct species from extinction. So it's possible that one day we may be able to bring back Ice Age animals like the mammoth back from extinction. This is something that's being actively discussed now in the scientific community. It's no longer just speculation. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we answered a lot of questions that I get. I was on Reddit.com the other day, and we had 1,000 questions that came in. There's no way I could answer all of them, so I tried to answer groups of questions that came in. And we had a series of questions about DNA and life. Well, with us today in the second half of Exploration is Robert Lanza. Dr. Lanza made history when he was able to take the DNA of a near-extinct animal and literally bring it back to life. And it means that one day we may be able to take the mammoth, extract usable DNA from the mammoth, inject it into a female elephant, and who knows, perhaps a mammoth will be born. And this, of course, has ethical and scientific implications. And so once again with us today is Dr. Lanza, a pioneer in biotechnology, who will talk to us about the frontiers of what happens if one day we can control our own genetic heritage. Now, Dr. Lanza, I understand when you were a child, you had a very interesting interaction with your family and as a budding scientist with real publishing scientists. Could you elaborate?
And I went to the ponds to catch snapping turtles and would climb trees to catch screech owls and flying squirrels. And so I'd go on these long trips trying to figure out the universe. And even at that age, I was in awe at the world. But unfortunately, my parents and none of my sisters had finished high school. So I, too, was placed in this slow class with the kids that used to throw the spitball. So I came up with this plan.
I know that.
Yeah. So I came up with this plan to prove myself. And actually, at that time, Watson and Crick had just cracked the genetic code just a few years earlier. So I decided to carry out what amounts to genetic engineering.
As a kid?
Yes. I was actually a teenager. I was around 14. And I had actually seen a black squirrel, and so I wanted to see whether I could make it albino or vice versa. And so I went to my biology teacher, and he told me that it was impossible, and everyone laughed at me. But I was determined to prove him wrong, so I went into my basement, and I figured out actually how to alter the genetic makeup of a white chicken to make him black by transferring genes from the pigmented chicken. And my mother thought I was just trying to hatch chicken eggs. So I decided, you know, to really prove this, I really needed to work with someone who understood that stuff. So, you know, to me, the greatest place on the planet was Harvard Medical School. So I saved up my nickels and dimes and took the buses and trolleys into Boston. And it actually took me half a day to get there. I didn't even know where I was going. So I tried to go in through the front door, and the guard didn't let me. It was sort of like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, you know, when the palace guard said, "Go away." But rather than leaving, I went around the back and I waited by the Dipsy dumpster, and I saw this little short, bald guy walking up with khaki pants and a bunch of keys. And I thought, oh, here's the janitor. So he opens the door and I just sort of slip in. And a little way down the corridor, he says, "Well, can I help you, sir?" And I said, "No, I'm looking for a Harvard doctor." Now, what I didn't know was that was Steven Kuffler, chairman of the neurobiology department. He had just been nominated for the Nobel Prize.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I thought that he was just the janitor, and so I told him that I was friends with the janitor down the street from me, and that I worked in the cafeteria, and so he asked me why I was there, and I said I was trying to alter the genetic makeup of a white chicken, and then I went on explaining about DNA, thinking he doesn't have a clue. And then he actually said, "Well, I know someone that can help you." And he brought me upstairs, past all the spaghetti wire and all, to Josh Sains, who now runs actually the Brain Center at Harvard. And he was just a grad student at the time. So after talking with Josh all day, they invited me back to repeat those experiments. And the work was ultimately published in Nature in 1974. And every now and then I would go back and the janitor would show up. And I was always so excited to see him. And it wasn't until later that I realized who he was. So that was actually how I got into the hard science.
And where did you get the equipment for your high school project interfering with the genes of living organisms? Where did you get your equipment?
Well, it was really very challenging. You have to remember I was just a little boy, very short. I didn't look very old. And, I'd be trying to get syringes, so I'd be at the hospitals trying to convince the doctors to give me syringes. And then I would go to another hospital and convince them to give me penicillin. And there was actually a gentleman who actually worked at one of the state labs who had a centrifuge in his cellar. So I put these all together and managed over a period of time to figure out how to do it in a very crude way.
So you created your own biotech laboratory in your basement?
Yeah, right next to the furnace. My mother actually had no idea I was doing it.
Amazing. When I was a kid, I built an atom smasher in my garage.
You're kidding.
Yeah, I had to go to Westinghouse.
So you understand.
Yeah, I went to Westinghouse to get 400 pounds of transformer steel and 22 miles of copper wire.
Wow.
To build a 2.3 million electron volt betatron in the garage. And you, as a kid, was out there meddling with the genes of living organisms.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a fun time.
Okay. Well, moving on now. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about cloning. We've heard so much about cloning in the media. Arnold Schwarzenegger even had a movie where he met his clone, and the whole movie was based on criminal clones.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is a clone, and how far are we in terms of being able to clone animals, primates, and maybe even humans?
Well, cloning is conceptually very simple. You basically take the self from the animal you want to clone and put it next to an empty egg that has had all of its DNA removed. And then you send an electrical charge through the two cells, and they fuse. So when the cells fuse, the DNA from the cell you want to clone is dumped into the empty egg. And another approach is just to inject the DNA directly into the empty egg. The next step is to use chemicals then to fool that egg into thinking it's been fertilized. And so then this cell starts to divide, and you end up with an embryo that can then be placed in a surrogate mother. And then if everything goes well, you can end up with a genetically identical copy of the animal you want to clone. And, of course, you know, we've cloned at this point many dozens of species. We've cloned endangered species, glow-in-the-dark mice, whole herds of cows. In fact, you know, there have been many farm animals, goats, pigs, cows, and even pets such as cats and dogs.
Now, we had a chance to interview Ian Wilmut, the Scottish scientist who actually cloned Dolly. Explain to us exactly what he did. What was Dolly, and was Dolly premature age? There was some controversy about that.
Well, yes. Ian Wilmut was the first to actually clone a mammal from an adult cell. And so he actually took a cell and went through the methodology I just described, and then that DNA was placed into an empty egg from another sheep. And when Dolly was born, everyone thought, because of the length of the telomeres, and these are the ends of the chromosomes that determine how many times a cell can divide, we all thought that cloning Dolly was basically an older sheep, in disguise. And so what we actually did is published a paper in 2000 that actually showed that wasn't the case, that you can actually start out with an old senescent cell that's decrepit, and the cloning procedure actually restores that cell to a youthful state and allows it once again to start dividing into an entire organism. So it actually turns out in the end, using not only just sheep, but also cows and mice, it's been shown repeatedly now that, in fact, cloning is like a little time machine. You can actually rejuvenate that DNA and actually end up with youthful cells.
So, in other words, you are literally turning back the biological clock, resetting it back to zero when this clone is born.
Absolutely. In fact, in some of the experiments we did, we actually were able to turn it back even more so that the cells actually had twice the lifespan that they normally should. So, again, the process is very irregular, so there's a possibility that, you know, that they may actually live shorter or longer, and a lot of that depends on many factors.
So, in other words, the cloned animal, in some sense, may actually be an improved version of the original animal with longer telomeres?
Well, certainly at the cellular level, we know that that is the case. Now, you know, obviously aging is very complex. There are other environmental factors that go into it. But certainly at the cellular level, we know that in some of these experiments, we actually have cells that lived quite extensively longer.
Okay. Now, what kinds of animals have been cloned? I understand that pets have been cloned, and I even went to Dallas, Texas with a film crew from BBC Television, where we went to a ranch where we saw clones of clones of clones, and one series of animals, we had like eight animal calves all lined up in a line. They were all identical twins. So what kinds of animals have been cloned?
Well, you know, the list is quite extensive, you know, starting from mice, rats, and rabbits. Again, all of the various farm animals, goats, pigs, horses. In fact, we created an entire herd of cows that actually was making human proteins in their milk that were genetically modified. On top of that, of course, you know, there are multiple different endangered species that have now been cloned. So in theory, virtually every mammal should in the future be able to be cloned.
Now, in the newspapers, every once in a while, some oddball announces that he's done the first human clone. However, as I understand, no primate has been successfully cloned. What's the status with regards to cloning primates and humans?
Well, as you point out, cloning primates, including humans, has been problematic. You know, back in 2001, we were actually the first group to clone the first early stage human embryos, and we were doing that for generating stem cells, not for reproductive purposes. And even to this date, the technique isn't perfected. Of course, there was the Wong scandal where for a while we thought that someone had that technique worked out. In fact, just a few months ago, we published a scientific paper where we showed for the first time that human cloning can't actually successfully reprogram human cells back to a normal embryonic state, and we're still working on that.
Now let's talk about your work, which is nothing less than fantastic. First of all, with endangered animals, you've been able to essentially bring back to life, genetically speaking, organisms that have been dead for 25 years. Explain your work.
Well, as you know, about 100 species go extinct every day, and those genes are lost from the planet forever. And so seeing that we're the ones that cause most of these extinctions, a while back I thought that, well, perhaps, you know, we had some responsibility to see if we could use some of our tools the best we can to reverse that. So back in 2000, I actually decided I would try to clone a gaur, which is an endangered ox-like creature from Asia, and it had been hunted almost to the verge of extinction. And I actually got some cells that from an animal that had died a few years earlier and tried to clone it using ordinary domestic cow eggs. And many of my colleagues said, well, Bob, that's impossible. You can't get a clone. You can't clone one species using the eggs from another species. And it turned out we actually were able to generate a beautiful little baby gaur embryos. We actually sent them off to IOR by FedEx Overnight Express, and they were implanted into ordinary farm cows. And 9 months later, we got a baby gaur, which we called Noah. It was born alive, walking around and bellowing. But then a couple days later, it died of dysentery. So everyone said, see, Bob, it doesn't work. So I went back to the San Diego Zoo and convinced them to, you know, let's give this a try again. So they said, well, you know, we actually have this what we call stud 391 that died back in 1980, a quarter of a century earlier. And he said, it would be great if you could bring that animal, resurrect that animal, so we could reintroduce that valuable genetic material into our highly inbred group of animals that they had. So they sent me a vial of these cells, and we transferred them into some empty cow eggs, and they were sent off again to IOR and implanted in some beef cattle that served as the surrogate moms. And we started with 16 pregnancies, and 9 months later, we were down to just two. And so there we were back in 2003. We were secretly gathered out in this farm out in the middle of nowhere, and we were watching this cow give birth by C-section. And I remember, you know, that, you know, when they started the C-section, there was some splatting of blood, and the vet reached in and pulled out from the mother's belly, you know, these two small hooves. And when they started to massage it, you know, suddenly its eyes opened and its ears started to wiggle, and it let out this big bellow, and everyone applauded. And the whole thing was so surreal. Here we were out in a farm in Iowa watching a beef cow give birth to this exotic endangered animal that's normally born in the bamboo jungles of Southeast Asia. It was really exciting.
Now, since then, I guess many other people have followed in your footsteps, right? So I guess many endangered animals have been brought back.
Yes, that is correct. And just recently in South Korea, I understand that they cloned an endangered wolf. You know, the hope is we've actually been in dialogue, you know, with some folks in China about the giant panda. But also, too, work is now going on to clone cheetahs and even the extinct Bucato mountain goat.
Now, I understand that the competition is so fierce that in South Korea, one of their leading researchers was tempted to commit fraud and basically faked all his papers claiming these fantastic results. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, actually, back at the early part of this decade, we actually, you know, there was an article on the cover of Wired where we were on the verge. We actually had cloned a pretty advanced stage human embryo. And at the time, everyone thought it was imminent that we were going to be publishing actually creating stem cells. And then just out of the blue, this group in South Korea, which no one had any knowledge of, published a paper in Science saying they had done it. So obviously, this individual thought he could do it, and his name was Wong. And unfortunately, it turned out many years later that the whole thing had been fabricated. It was just a complete disaster. You know, it actually, you know, terminated most of the research we were doing. Everyone had just assumed that this feat had been accomplished. You know, it was one of the biggest scandals in scientific history. It was just terrible.
And in fact, some of my colleagues were wondering why he did it to disgrace the whole country, because at some point it would come out. However, the leading theory is that he probably thought that some group around the world was going to do it anyway. So why not simply beat them out by a few months to a few years? And then people will forget. People will overlook things and not go into the details and find out that he was a total fraud.
No, absolutely. I know he was convinced that in a few months we were going to publish a paper showing we could do it. And then everyone would say, see, it works. And, you know, and then he would have gone on and got his Nobel Prize. And in fact, the government gave him millions and millions of dollars and literally thousands of human eggs. And so I'm sure he was certain that he would be able to achieve it and no one would ever know. In fact, he pulled into his group, you know, some of the top cloning experts in the world, you know, Shatton and even Ian Wilmot in the end was working with him. So I'm sure he figured out with all of the brain power and resources that this would be pretty simple to do. And as you know, it's turned out to be a lot more difficult than anyone thought.
Now, let's talk about something that is science fiction,
okay.
Bringing back extinct animals, including the Neanderthal.
Mm-hmm.
On this show, we've had people that are very interested in sequencing the genome of the Neanderthal. Our nearest species, which died out tens of thousands of years ago in Europe. And believe it or not, they expect the full genome of the Neanderthal to be sequenced in the coming years. And there's talk about maybe bringing back the Neanderthals. Any comments?
Yeah, I think that, you know, on many of these, you know, extinct species, including the Neanderthal and dinosaurs, that at some point in the future, we may have that technology. I think, you know, even today, I know, like, for instance, when you come to my house, I have this 6-foot brontosaurus bone that weighs 800 pounds. And you know, it's from one of the largest dinosaurs that ever roamed the earth. And the first thing everyone asks me is, Bob, are you going to clone this? And I tell them, you can't clone from stone. You need living cells, or certainly the tissue. And as you mentioned, once we have the genome, we may be able to incorporate that into a living cell. Now, the thing to remember is that it's a little more complicated than that because there's two genomes in the cell, the mitochondrial genome, and that has to talk with the nuclear genome. So that presents a bit of a problem because even if you have the DNA for, you know, the species itself, what determines you or the Neanderthal or the dinosaur, you still need to figure out how to get that to be able to interact with the maternally transferred genetics. So again, you know, I always say that you're not going to be seeing dinosaurs in your backyard anytime soon. Again, the Neanderthal tissue as well as the mammoth that was unearthed a few years ago, you have to realize that after years of freezing and thawing, that there have been holes poked in the animal's DNA. And right now, molecular biologists don't know how to fill in the gaps. And the same thing applies, I think, to the Tasmanian tiger, which died out in the 1930s in Australia. But I think someday we are going to learn how to either sequence the entire genome or to repair the DNA. But again, that's going to be many years off.
Now, with the woolly mammoth, we've actually had several people involved in that project on exploration. Mm-hmm. And they tell me that if you extract DNA from the carcasses of these animals that died thousands and thousands of years ago in Siberia, you just get fragments, little pieces here and there all over the place, and it's pretty hard to make sense out of it. However, with computers, we're going to get very good at putting pieces together and having the computer put the jigsaw puzzle together. So what do you think? Maybe one day a computer using what is called bioinformatics,
mm-hmm.
you think they may be able to piece it together using, let's say, a blueprint of an elephant genome?
I think absolutely. I think we have a lot of tricks in our toolbox, something known as homologous recombination, which will allow us to go in and splice the genes right in precisely where we'd like them. And there are some newer techniques evolving. And then, of course, you would require a very powerful computer, seeing that I think someone once compared it to shredding up the New York phone directory into little pieces and then having to reassemble it. But with computers, as you know, they're very powerful and we're discovering new tricks. So I think sometime in the future, yes, that we definitely should be able to do this.
Now, about 2 months ago, I did a book tour in London, and I went to Oxford. I had dinner with Richard Dawkins, one of the leading biologists in the world. And he's on record as stating that perhaps one day we'll be able to take the genome of a human, compare it to the genome of a chimpanzee, analyze the genes that are different, and then with a computer program, interpolate between them in order to get the best approximation for the genome of the missing link, Australopithecus. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, he says this is an outrageous idea. Mm-hmm. He's very careful to say that. But it's an idea that can't be ruled out. You have any thoughts about such an outrageous idea as one day bringing back not just a Neanderthal, but the missing link?
I think all that is possible in the future. There's no question about it. Once we have the tools to manipulate the genetics, already today we know how to knock out genes, for instance, to increase the muscle mass of an animal to twice its original amount. So I think we already have some of those tools, and we're adding them very quickly. So yes, I think it could be done, but as you mentioned, I think there's this ethical concern that it will probably prevent it from occurring. I mean, even when we, generated the first cloned embryo, even for medical purposes, I mean, it was a huge outcry. It's very, very controversial. So, yes, in theory, I think we will eventually have the scientific tools to do it. The question will be, should we?
And speaking about ethics and the dark side, maybe you saw the movie The Island. In that movie, it's a very dark plot. People find out, much to their shock, that they are actually clones of a real person. They didn't realize that they were imposters. They always thought they were real humans. Mm-hmm. But they were cloned in order to harvest the organs of their body. In other words, they were raised to be killed, mm-hmm. so that the organs of their body could be harvested and then given to a rich man who actually paid big bucks to have their body cloned. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you can't clone memories. That's mm-hmm. not possible. But do you think that is the way some people are going to go? Or you think we'll simply grow organs separately from having to clone the entire body?
Yeah, well, I think there's a consensus in the medical and scientific community that you would never allow any kind of a clone to go past the first several days of cell division. So it would be smaller than, the head of a pin. So I think what we would do is what we're doing now is you would create embryonic stem cells or what we call now iPS cells for pluripotent stem cells. And those cells are immortal and they grow. And we can now turn those into virtually every cell type in the body. And through a new techniques that are developing in a field known as tissue engineering, we can reconstitute those into more complex tissues and structures. In fact, I published a paper with Tony et al. A number of years ago where we actually used clone cells from a cow to grow in the lab kidneys that actually were able to remove toxic materials when we transplanted them back into the animal they were cloned from. And those cells were very smart. They had assembled into the glomeruli, into all the various elements of the kidney. And since that time, work has been done to grow in the lab entire bladders that have been used in patients. And in fact, there's work now where people have actually created primitive beating hives using this tissue engineering technique. So one day you're going to go to the hospital, we'll take a skin cell, and we'll just grow you up a new kidney or whatever you need.
And speaking about that, I went with a film crew from BBC Television down to Wake Forest University, where you're also a professor. Mm-hmm. And we actually went through Tony et al.'s laboratory where we photographed heart valves that are opening and closing, opening and closing. Heart valves that were grown from your own cells. Mm-hmm. So now we can grow bladders. The first windpipe was grown recently. Now, where is it going to go? Are we going to be able to grow, for example, a liver? If that happens, think of all the people who die because they don't get a liver in time, like Mickey Mantle, the great baseball giant, died of liver failure. Mm-hmm. Is the liver, the pancreas, are they coming?
Absolutely. We're making enormous progress on tissue engineering virtually every organ system in the body, including bones and tendons. And also, too, we're now on the forefront of what we now are able to do is to actually a new paradigm in medicine where we're able to actually generate early developmental cells that only exist transiently in the embryo and use them to repair the adult body almost like nanoparticles. So, for instance, we published a paper a couple of years ago where we created what we call these hemangioblasts, and they were like ambulance cells. And when we injected them into the body, we found that in animals that had had massive heart attacks, that it actually cut the death rate in half, a simple injection. Or in animals where, for instance, they would otherwise have their legs amputated due to lack of blood flow, we completely restored the blood flow by injecting these cells. In the same manner, the liver, we believe we have cells that will be able to repair that. So I think in the next few years, you're going to see a lot more of this work published. And yes, I think you're going to be able to repair virtually any worn out or dysfunctional tissue in the body.
Well, that concludes our interview with Dr. Robert Lanza, a leader in biotechnology who made history when he literally brought back an animal once thought to be on the verge of extinction back to life. And it makes you wonder, is it possible that one day we could control our own genetic heritage? Well, there's a new discovery being made that could very easily generate a whole slew of Nobel Prizes, and that is CRISPR technology. It's now possible to literally edit, just like you edit a book by cutting it apart and underlining certain parts and rejoining them. It's possible to edit our DNA, almost like editing a book. This is potentially revolutionary, but it also raises tremendous ethical problems, so much that in the field of biotechnology, hastily put together conferences have taken place where scientists are rapidly trying to digest the ethical implications of all of this. So no longer are we talking about somatic gene therapy, where you change the genes of an animal for just one generation. When that animal dies, the genetic mutations also die with it. But you're now talking about changing the entire germline, that is, the entire genetic heritage of a species. It really makes you think about the consequences of this technology. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and you've been listening to Exploration. Join us every week on Exploration when we discuss the impact of science on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.